It's the Return to Mars edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Curiosity on Mars, Awful Atheist, and Quack Medicine and Your Pets. Let's begin episode 177.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
UHF is good. Touchdown confirmed. We're safe on Mars. Time to see where our curiosity will take us.
So that was the celebration of a bunch of very happy scientists, because that is the mission control for the Mars Science Laboratory. And that cheering you hear is Curiosity turning out to be a success. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. So Ethan, you were talking about, you know, this thing on Mars. It's not that big of an issue, was it? I mean, did anyone really notice? Did they really care, you know, at NASA? I mean, there was a big cheers, but they do that all the time, don't they?
So NASA hasn't had cause to cheer for a while, but they did have cause to cheer Sunday night, because around 10:30 Pacific Standard Time marked one of the greatest technological achievements in human history. Curiosity, or also known as the Mars Science Laboratory, touched down on the Martian surface. Now, Curiosity is one of the largest rovers ever built, and because it is one of the largest rovers ever built, it had a very complicated and tricky landing procedure. And had this thing crashed and burned, well, NASA would have been about $2 billion in the hole. So this is a pretty big win for them, and not just them, for science as well. I mean, this is going to be a pretty impressive rover, nuclear-powered machine on Mars that can act as an avatar for the human race and exploring and perhaps learning a little bit about the history of Mars.
No, it was quite a thrilling thing to kind of watch. Although, you know what, Ethan, I was so very annoyed. You can't beat the luck of the Irish, if only I was Irish. I was watching it on NASA TV. I thought, what better source than NASA TV? But for some reason, there was like a 10 or 20-minute delay. And I was following your little notes on Facebook about, oh, they've got this part. And I'm looking at the TV and I'm going, wait a minute, that doesn't quite seem to jive. And then I eventually went over to the CBC feed and I was like, oh, there it is.
Yeah, there were some problems with the feed. It was actually kind of interesting because I was watching three live feeds at once. There was a Google Hangout with astronomers like Phil Plait, Pamela Gay, and Fraser Kane. And even they were remarking many times, who has the NASA feed? Because apparently the NASA feed was going down. I actually had two different feeds, one from the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratories, which was working fine and where I watched most of the action. There was also another feed that I was watching, which was basically the same thing, only from the point of view of a couple of commentators who had a desk. And the funny thing is you could see the desk in the background on one of the feeds, and you could see the background mission control in the other one. And they would have like scientists and engineers come up and do little, you know, sort of quick interviews. But I had a great time watching. I mean, it was kind of stressful because you're sitting there going, come on, come on, come on. And you're hoping that it's not going to crash, and that would just be really depressing. And they'd be all like, oh, all that, you know, money and time wasted. But it was a smashing success. And the great thing was, I mean, almost well, not immediately because there was a delay, of course, but they were able to send back pictures really quickly after the landing. And some of those pictures are really amazing.
That was the one thing that I actually quite liked a bit, because I've seen some of these other sort of landmark things, right? You know, the Viking, among others. And there's always just like, okay, it's landed. Give us a day or so, and then you'll be able to start to see some of the pictures. The fact that this was like almost instantaneous was quite good. Well, instantaneous plus the time it takes to get from Mars to Earth.
Right. And the other thing we had to deal with was what was called the 7 minutes of terror. Because there was a delay, about 14 minutes, I believe, that when Curiosity radioed back to Mission Control, they didn't use a radio, but I'm just using that expression, they knew that by the time Curiosity had landed, they were just getting the message saying that it's attempting to land. So they're sitting there waiting for the updates, knowing that right now Curiosity is either sitting in a pile of rubble or it's already successfully landed. So there was this, you know, sense of anticipation, but again, terror as well, because they didn't know that Curiosity made it. They were still wondering whether or not it was going to happen, even though technically it already had happened.
Some people were sort of saying that, oh, you know, this 7 minutes of terror is just sort of a marketing scheme by NASA. And maybe to a degree it kind of was. But I was just watching a documentary, The Universe, and they were talking about Mars. And this is like about 3 or 4 years ago. And they used the exact same term when they were talking about the Phoenix lander, right? But you said, Ethan, that this was a exciting, sort of really complicated, traumatic sort of entry. What exactly went on with the entry onto the planet?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Don, because I have prepared some statements.
Did you check it with your lawyer first?
I did, and they approve. So Curiosity, as I mentioned before, was one of the largest rovers ever built, and it wasn't going to – they couldn't have used the same procedure that they've used for past landers. It was simply too large. So basically, what Curiosity turned out to be was sort of like a transformer, because it had about four different landing procedures, and it required to – basically move in and out of its capsule, move its landing gear around, basically transforming as it went through the Martian atmosphere. The first was guided entry, and the rover in this stage was folded up within a aeroshell that protected it during travel through space and during atmospheric entry in Mars. So 10 minutes before the atmospheric entry, the aeroshell separated from the cruise stage that was providing power, the communications, propulsion. That separates. So 1 minute after separation from the cruise stage, the thrusters on the aeroshell fired to cancel out the spacecraft's rotation. This achieved, you know, orientation with the heat shield, so it's facing Mars and it's not going to, you know, spiral out of control or something. So the second phase was the parachute descent. This is when the entry phase is complete and the capsule is slowed to Mach 1.7, slowed, and the supersonic parachute is deployed. Now, they've done this before with previous landers like Viking and Pathfinder and the exploration rovers. This parachute, however, had 80 suspension lines and was over 160 feet long. And this is about 52 feet in diameter. And the parachute itself is capable of being deployed at Mach 2.2 and can generate up to 65,000 pounds of drag force in the Martian atmosphere. So that was pretty impressive on its own. That's still not enough, though, to get Curiosity safely to the ground. So the third phase was powered descent. So after the parachute breaks at about 1.8 kilometers altitude, and this is, we're still traveling at about 220 miles per hour, the rover and the descent stage dropped out of the aeroshell, and the descent stage is a platform above the rover with 8 variable thrust monopropellant hygiene rocket thrusters. Probably saying that 5 times fast. Mm-hmm. And this allowed the rover to slow the descent. Each rocket thruster could propel, you know, force down. It's sort of like the what you would see in, you know, movies when those old-fashioned rockets would land and their little thrusters would be firing to slow its descent. Finally, after this third phase, came the sky crane. Now, Curiosity is too heavy to use the airbag landing system that was used on Pathfinder or Mars Exploration. And a legged lander approach would have caused several design problems. And, well, so basically, they had to come up with a whole new system to get this rover down safely. And that was the Sky Crane, which is just pretty awesome.
It sounds just like a superhero. It's Sky Crane to the rescue.
Yeah, or like a James Bond-style invention by Q or something. But it actually is one of these amazing little things. The Sky Crane basically lowers the rover with a 25-foot tether. And now the rover has its wheels, of course. And the idea here is that the Sky Crane sort of carries it down to about where the wheels can touch the ground. And then it has to detach so that the wheels touch down nice and gently. Well, not too gently, but, you know, not that it's not going to break the thing. And then the Sky Crane has to go crash because it's going way too fast, right? So if you can imagine this, it's sort of like if a car was falling through the sky attached to, you know, one of those giant cranes that move it, move a broken car to like a junkyard or something like that. That's sort of what it was like. And just as it's about to hit the ground, it detaches, the Sky Crane goes off and crashes, and the rover lands safely on the ground on Mars. Isn't that amazing?
That is so, so cool. Can I buy one? Are they for sale?
Yeah, I don't think they're commercially available just yet. And also, they're not really useful unless you're going to drop something out of the sky.
So that was incredible landing. Now, of course, now that it's there, maybe I'm going to take over and mention a few of the things that it actually sort of tools it has that it's going to be using there. One of the interesting aspects about this is that it uses a plutonium radioisotope thermometric generator. So there's like apparently 4.6 kilograms of plutonium oxide it's using as a fuel to essentially create heat. That heat is turned into electricity. Now, in theory, the half-life of the plutonium used is 86 years. So in theory, it could last for generations. But in practice, they expect it to be powered up and running for at least 2 years. According to the radio reports I've been listening to, that some people think it might go up to 10 years or so of being an active part of NASA. We'll see about that. Above and beyond that, it has its master cam, which is sort of the cam on a mast, and it's got super high-resolution CCDs on it. So it's going to be able to take fantastic pictures in full color and all that and send them back to Earth, which is kind of cool. It also has a hand lens imager. So essentially, it's a microscope on one of its arms. It can take high-resolution microscopic photos of the rocks and all that's on there. It also contains white and ultraviolet LEDs. So again, they get an idea of the luminescence of it, which tells you a bit about the properties about this. Of course, it's got a bunch of navigation cams. And another interesting thing about this, as Ethan had mentioned with the 7 minutes of terror, is you can't really steer these particular devices. I mean, it's so far away, you got to kind of tell it, well, I want you to go from here to here, and try not to hit anything along the way. And it's got to sort of navigate itself. So it has a whole bunch of interesting high-tech sort of cameras and software and a lot to help it navigate, which will be an interesting because the better it gets, the more we can do on the next trip. It also has a few of what they call chemistry complex cams. And this one I thought was really, really cool. So essentially, it's a spectrograph that is attached to a laser that can shoot up to 7 meters away, vaporizing a small amount of whatever it is they're interested in. And then the camera takes a quick look at it, gets a spectrographic image of it so they can tell what exactly it's made of. They also, of course, have, you know, radioactive decay elements, your traditional sort of chemistry, mineralogy, diffractors and fluorescence so they can do some chemistry tests. But another big aspect of it is the sample analysis at Mars, or the SAM, and it's going to be used to do essentially, is there life on Mars sort of thing, or was there ever life on Mars? It's a series of spectrometers, chromatographs, the sort of, you know, high-tech things that tells you what's in things, and they're going to test things for like methane and different kind of carbon constituents that are in the rocks and the soil and the regolith on the planet to, again, keep hitting this thing, you know. Mars could have had some form of basic life at least a few billion years ago. Is there any evidence left on the surface? it also will help us determine, you know, if we go there and we try and set up a colony on Mars, what kind of resources in the dirt, in the ground, can we expect? So again, if we want to set up something like a greenhouse or something like that, we will have a good idea. Is the soil of sufficient quality to grow plants as we know them, provided we provide the atmosphere for it, or what kind of nutrients we're going to need? So overall, you know, it's an exciting landing for what's going to be a really exciting mission.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you've seen some of the pictures that it's sending back already, they're really amazing. Especially the really cool thing is that there's some satellites in orbit that were taking pictures of Curiosity landing. And you can see some of these photos with its parachute deployed, and they're just awe-inspiring. So, you know, we'll have some links to those on our webpage, so check them out because they're just awesome.
Yes. Maybe we'll take a little break. Let everyone, you know, recover from their overexcitedness about Curiosity, although you can never be overexcited about missions to other planets. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about some, well, not so nice atheists. Standing on a planet, really,
I'm just a speck, compared with a star. Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So, who are the five most awful atheists?
Ethan, wait a minute. We know, because we're both atheists, so everyone who's an atheist must be a good person. And if we say that if an atheist is a bad person, aren't we sort of saying in some odd way that we ourselves are bad people?
Well, I suppose if you're using some pretty essentialist determinations, but maybe. The actual article here, the five most awful atheists, I think we can debate whether or not it's spot on or just plain wrong. But it's an interesting origin behind this article. It was written for the Alternet website, which is an online news magazine and community resource for independent news and information. And the article in question was written by Ian Murphy, who is an editor for the Buffalo-based independent newspaper, The Beast. And Murphy makes an interesting claim, and he suggests that there really is only one requirement to be in the so-called rationalist movement, which is his words, in America, and that is disbelief in God or gods. Now, I mean, I think that's an assertion that we could really debate, but we should probably go on to the actual list itself, because, you know, we've talked about these people's, with the exception of maybe one of them, before on the show, so it might not be too big a surprise, but we'll be curious to see what our listeners think about this. So, I guess in no particular order, Murphy lists the five worst atheists. Number one is Sam Harris. Now, Harris, of course, is known for his anti-Muslim writings. He's somewhat been labeled a neoconservative. And, well, he has done a certain amount of good breaking the spell, so to speak, that religion holds, and making us well aware that we need to be able to criticize religion. He's also gone on quite a holy war, if you can use that term, on Islam, calling it sort of the biggest threat to Western civilization since, I don't know, the Black Plague or something. And then additionally, you have all his other hang-ups, whether his idea that torture and racial profiling are justified, and his somewhat strange views on things like meditation and whatnot. There's an interesting quote that Murphy has about Harris, and he says, "Harris is basically a low-rent Hitchens, sans wit or the wisdom to waterboard himself." So, I mean, interesting. I mean, those are not things about Harris that we ourselves haven't also lamented. So,
well, there is one thing I'm going to pick up on this, and I think we'll see this be a reoccurring theme. And perhaps this is one of the, I don't know, maybe not errors of Ian Murphy, because again, it depends on how you take what he was trying to do with this. But some people will have great ideas. But just because they have a great idea doesn't mean every idea they have is great. So Sam Harris, one of the things I think he did was great is the whole idea that moderates create a space for radicals to exist. And I agree with that. We may debate about that. But I think that was kind of one of his great contributions to the atheist movement. That being said, and as Ethan has kind of sort of hinted on here, since then, he's really just sort of picked on Muslims, that he sort of gives everyone else, you know, a token sort of criticism. But really, as you say, you know, Muslims are the worst thing since the Crusades, if I can make that statement. So you're right. I mean, he's done some things that I think promote the movement. But at the same time, he is a very flawed person in his own right.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I think that there's another aspect to Murphy's sort of criticisms, and we'll notice them as we go through these. But Murphy is also throwing people, I guess you could say, under the bus here, who don't share his personal political views. I mean, that's pretty clear in his criticism. Neoconservatives sort of take the most of his ire. And again, we can debate whether or not that's justified or not. But that being said, we are trying to talk about someone here who claims to be a rationalist, but then, you know, embraces some pretty irrational ideas. But let's move on to part two here. The second most awful atheist is someone that I would probably agree with here, Bill Maher, so the host of Real Time. And Murphy points out some of the reasons why, his veiled misogyny, his notion that fat poor people just need to like eat whole foods, his self-righteous condensation in all things religious and political. And of course, Bill Maher is known for being sort of an anti-science wacko who claimed that getting a flu shot is the worst thing you can do. And there's another quote here from Murphy on Maher. Bill Maher has to stop booking half-bright libertarians who rhetorically roll his uninformed ass, or he needs to start reading books.
You know, I kind of did a little bit of a defense of Sam Harris. And although I kind of like some of the words that Bill Maher will say on occasion, he doesn't have the same sort of intellectual strength that Sam Harris had, at least on one or two issues. So, again, I'm not sure what to say about this. I mean, he does. Bill Maher constantly goes into woo land with his whole, you know, I think it's rooted in anti-corporatism. So, I mean, in that sense, maybe we're the same vein. But a lot of the idea of atheism itself, which is, of course, the focus of this, is a criticism of dogma in itself. And Bill Maher, I think, is someone who's very dogmatic in a lot of his views.
Oh, yeah. I've heard it mentioned before, but I would repeat that I think Bill Maher is an ideologue. I think that he's not an atheist after arriving at careful critical scrutiny of the facts. I think he's an atheist because he happens to like that idea, and he doesn't care what evidence is required or needed. He just is going to promote his view of the world. And I mean, that being said, I thought his movie Religious or Religious, or however you say that, was funny and perhaps worth seeing. But some of his other views are just complete garbage. So moving on to the next worst atheist, no surprise, it's Penn Jillette. So again, not surprising reasons why Murphy doesn't take kindly to Jillette. Economic libertarianism, unable to call bullshit on Ayn Rand. Apparently, Penn and Teller used to carry around a copy of Atlas Shrugged on tour. And apparently from Jillette's own admission, he is an atheist because he doesn't know anything else, which is, I think, kind of, again, one of those a very silly reason to believe anything. And, you know, again, I think you can make the same arguments that you made about Maher. Jillette's misogyny, his occasional dabblings in sort of odd beliefs. I think in Jillette's case, it's anything that has to do with politics Gillette sort of abandons any notion of critical thinking. I mean, regardless of whether you agree with his conclusions, how he arrives at those conclusions is usually complete rhetoric and really not informed by any kind of facts.
In an odd sort of way, he's sort of the godless of the gap. You know, I mean, that because he doesn't know any better, if it's true, strikes me as a rather odd way to go. And I think in some ways, going with his own libertarian viewpoints, he would have to almost be antithetical to any sort of a creator, because then he'd sort of owe the creator something, and he couldn't be the rugged individualist. Every libertarian must be just because that's what they think.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. The next person on Murphy's list is Ayaan Hirsi Ali. Now, I'm going to quote him here. "While she's to be commended for her staunch defense of women suffering under Sharia law, the Somali-born former Dutch politician's few good deeds shouldn't absolve her of being to Islam what Ayn Rand was to communism." Now, this, of course, is referring to Ali's really, really direct calls for the destruction of Islam. She surpasses Harris in her zeal to see Islam discredited. And in many cases, she calls for either Islam to be destroyed, Muslims to be converted to Christianity. She's made statements like denying Muslims their First Amendment rights under the U.S. Constitution. And I think the thing with Ali that we've mentioned on the show before is that she's someone who has an intense emotional investment in this, on the issue of Islam and the West. And it's very difficult to assume that she can be unbiased when analyzing these issues. So some people might be hesitant to put her on a list of the worst atheists, but given that some of her claims have been extreme in their, well, xenophobia, it's not too hard to argue.
Well, and another quote that was in the article that, again, I'm not sure where he's going with this, but he makes a quote where he said, "The killer was on welfare. He had the time to plot a murder," which in the United States he would not be, i.e. that somehow socialism was responsible for this death and somehow. And I mean, she is, again, not a very nice person. If you, you know, if you exclude the atheism and you think, well, atheism is good, the rest of what she has to say is a bit, and there's some, you know, her history is very tangled. So you're right. You know, there does seem to be, though, a certain trend to all these. But is there anyone else on this list?
Well, the other person on the list is interesting to me because I've never heard of this person before.
Oh, you must not listen to a lot of politics, because she comes up a lot of the time. And it's usually S.E., not the name you're going to give.
Yeah, I know. But I used the name because I didn't know who it was. Sarah Elizabeth Cupp. So this person is a devout Randoid. Atheist outlier, co-host of MSNBC's newly minted phony balance media abortion The Cycle, and that's more Murphy's words than mine. And basically, she's sort of this conservative atheist, although there's most speculation that she's sort of the token atheist on the conservative side. She's definitely libertarian-esque, anti-left, and sort of fills that kind of strange gap on the political right that is, on one hand, anti-religious, but also anti-science as well. So, yeah, I don't know too much about her. Maybe, Don, you could talk a bit more about her and why she's on this list.
Well, you know, so S.E. Cupp, which is often how they have it, she's one of these very attractive sort of women that they put on TV. She is, as you say, sort of the token atheist in the conservative. So whenever there's an issue that comes up where you've kind of got, well, you know, the church has too much rights and we need to do something that seems to be of a theocratic bent, they bring her on and she says, well, you know, I'm an atheist, but I can understand where these people are coming from and I really support them. And I mean, it's almost to the point, if you ever hear her talk, that with the exception of when someone says, are you an atheist? She says, yes. She never, ever sort of walks the walk, right? When it comes to sort of the idea of separation of church and state, she never really promotes that sort of aspect, at least nothing I've ever seen her in. And again, it's atheist in name only. I'm sure there's an acronym for that, but yeah.
Well, I was reading P.Z. Myers. He commented on this article in his blog, and he mentioned that he didn't believe that any of them were beyond redemption except for Cupp. Which leads me to ask, Don, what do you think of this list? Do you think these folks here are beyond redemption, or that they may one day contribute something of value to the free thought movement?
Well, again, sort of going down the list, I suspect someone like Sam Harris is suffering from sort of post-traumatic stress syndrome from 9/11. A number of people, and I think Hitchens would be on this same sort of list, were deeply affected by 9/11. And because of that sort of emotional scarring, focused in disproportionately upon Islam, especially in the United States. I mean, if I was in Egypt or, I mean, something like that, I may see Islam as a direct threat to me. But in the United States, it is such a small minority. And with the exception of one, granted, very horrific exception to the rule, there are a lot more things you should be worrying about as far as religion affecting my life. So in that sense, I think Sam Harrison, you know, has some redeemability. Bill Maher, no. I think Bill Maher, as you sort of pointed out, hit upon atheism as something to make him sort of stand out. It's sort of like, hey, listen, I'm against all established sort of thing. I'm against corporations, against the church, I'm against big state. I'm all, you know, against that. So it's really just sort of a rehashing of his own political ideology, and not in the good sense of the word. And speaking of ideology, Penn Jillette, someone asked me once whether I thought it was more important to sort of focus on trying to defeat, if you can use that word, libertarian movement, or defeat the Christian or theological movement. And I sort of said, well, it's more important, I think, to do the theological. And one of the justifications for that is that libertarianism is innately contradictory, that it will always fall under its own weight. There is no such thing as a libertarian society, with the possible exception of Somalia, and look how good it's working there. And if you do any of the sort of libertarian ideas, they're self-defeating. But I think he really believes it, so I'm not sure about that. You kind of mentioned that Ali is a damaged person, so again, maybe she sort of falls into 9/11. But if it wasn't for the atheism, I'd probably say she's not a very nice person. I wouldn't want to be around her. And we've already talked about S.E. Cups.
Right.
Yourself, do you agree with this analysis? I mean, I've said quite a few things here. You've kind of rehashed a bit of what was in the article. But do these people have a snowball's chance in, well, someplace?
Well, you know, I think that Harris, as much as I disagree with a lot of what he says regarding things like racial profiling and torture and that sort of thing, I do think that his past contributions at least should earn him a bit of sympathy, simply because some of his past writings have been very revolutionary in, you know, making the skeptics movement a popular movement. So at the very least, I'm willing to give him a bit more benefit than the others. Now, that being said, he really needs to take, I think, a more rational approach to how he is, you know, researching and presenting his ideas. And if I have to listen to him talk about, like, how evil Islam is one more time, I'm probably just going to write him off entirely. So it really depends. He recently put up his latest book for free. So I downloaded it and I'm going to read it and we'll see what happens. But I don't know. Bill Maher, on the other hand, I was ready to write off Bill Maher a long time ago. And honestly, I think he's a crank. And sure, he's an atheist. But again, like, there's lots of people out there who are atheists who also believe that, you know, aliens brought life to Earth and all this kind of stuff. Bill Maher is an anti-skeptic. If there could be anything such, if there is such a thing as an anti-skeptic, it's Bill Maher. So I'm happy to see him go. Penn Jillette, one of these fellows who I think has really seen his star decline in the last 18 months in the skeptics community. You know, not just because of his sort of really kind of anti-harassment position in the skeptic scene, but also I think that people have gotten a little bit tired of his sort of libertarianism. And I think he actually has this kind of a special kind of libertarianism. The fact that he's so loud and obnoxious about it as well kind of irks people. The example I can think of is the episode they did on their show about smoking, which was just a travesty of science. But anyway, I my personal opinion is I really don't care much for Jillette anymore. Whether or not he can turn his image around is really hard to say. And then for the last two, you know, Ellie, I think you're right. Like, if it wasn't for her sort of support of women suffering under Islam, I don't know if she would be on the radar, because again, she doesn't sound like a very nice person. People seem to gloss over the fact that she is pretty right wing, and she's not just right wing as we think of it on the conservative side here in North America. She's right wing in Europe, which is very nationalistic and quite a bit scary as well. So I don't know if I want her name associated with my side of the argument. And Cup, I mean, yeah, I think that like PZ Myers, I don't think there's much hope for someone like this, who I would even suspect that she's not actually an atheist, that she's just sort of the token spokesperson for a movement that the conservative right of America just doesn't understand.
Now, you know, this actually kind of leads us to perhaps the big final question in all this. And again, it's a little, well, you probably read it better than I did, ambiguous as to what was sort of the point of this particular article in itself. And it's one of those things that I think almost every skeptic will eventually, any committed skeptic will eventually be an atheist. But that doesn't mean every atheist is a good skeptic. And by that, I mean how you come to your atheism is very, very important. Just to say, well, I don't believe there's such a thing as a God is an assertion. It's not actually good thinking in and of itself. I mean, I agree with the conclusion, but you've missed the whole point about how did you get there? And for people like me, and I'm going to assume perhaps you as well, Ethan, is that, you know, we looked at theological beliefs, we looked at the reasoning for them, the evidence that supported it, and we said, well, no, there just wasn't any there, and that, you know, this particular religion is no different than these other ones, and they all sort of fall into the same sort of fail rate. Whereas if you sit there and you say, well, I don't believe in God, you fall into the Stalinist sort of the trap. You know, everyone said, well, Stalin was an atheist, and see, that shows that all atheists can be really, really bad people. Well, ignoring the fact that although they did not believe in God, they still believed in all the bad thinking that led to God or religion. And that's why you got the cult of personality in Stalinist Russia. That, you know, without the good skeptical tools that brings you to atheism, just to say you're an atheist doesn't really mean that much.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that that's one of the reasons why it's really important to sort of have that kind of marriage of secular humanism with scientific skepticism, because it keeps both sides honest. And when you sort of lack one of those things, well, you get some pretty strange beliefs, like, you know, Bill Maher and the anti-vax movement.
And the inconsistency, right? Consistency is important. How can you sit there and you say, well, you know, it's really silly to believe that there's this, you know, power out there that's controlling everything from some mythical place that they call heaven, and at the same time, completely accept the idea that there's some sort of Illuminati plot to cause cancer through vaccination. It just strikes me as nuts.
Well, why don't we take a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker? When we come back, we'll talk about quack medicine for our pets.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
And we're back. So now we're going to take a little look at quack medicine and our loving pets. We received a few emails recently about the Vancouver Orphan Kitten Rescue and their apparent promoting of homeopathic medicine for our feline friends. My research, I must be honest, didn't turn up that much. There is at least a Facebook posting out there page about a poor little kitten who had an eye infection that was being treated with homeopathic medicine. And for those of you who don't know what homeopathic medicine, it's water, and a bit about on their website about how to find out about unsafe toys, which link to a holistic site as an expert source. For those who don't know about holistics, holistic sites is not necessarily the kiss of death, but quite often it's the idea is you get everything and you bring it all together. And if you mean, you know, did we test it to see whether animals will choke? Did we test it in an environment so that we know how the animal will use it? That's sort of the good holistics, where they sit there and they say, well, we tested its chi to see whether the energy fields were appropriate for the animal. That's sort of when it goes sort of out of bounds. Now, in looking at the events about the story, I did find some references on their website for this rescue center to Petternship Project, which is sort of the animal version of the mind-body-soul bazaar we reported on a few years ago. So first, I think that the Vancouver Kitten Orphanage seems to be, by and large, a worthy project that has a couple of bad thinkers in their midst. They promote vaccination for cats. They do tell you to go to a real veterinarian if you think your pet's at risk. They promote something called Pet First Aid, which is also seems to be pretty above board. So it seems that the site itself is about 95% legit. Still worthy of our keeping an eye on it, because there is, of course, some people out there who think that not treating your animal will somehow cure it. But by and large, it seems to be not that bad. So we can rest a little easy about worrying about the kittens at this particular place. They are sort of based on a communal organization where instead of kenneling pets like the SPCA does, they keep cats in sort of foster homes that provide material support until a new permanent home can be found. And again, this is one of the areas where, you know, the woo medicine can come in. That said, it did raise the issue of quack medicine perpetrated on our beloved pets. So we'll sort of focus more on the Petternship Project, which is sort of pet and internship thrown into one word just to make my pronunciations difficult, expose some of the woo and quackery that's actually was promoted on that site. First, and I think least, and this I found pushed heavily even on the orphan site, the Petternship site and most of their links, they apply to sort of the naturalistic fallacy, if I can use that term incorrectly, about raw food. They talk about how animals like dogs and cats are just that, animals, and as such have evolved to eat living things, and thus we should mainly feed them raw meat. I read one place that said, quote, that kitten on your lap has been designed by nature to be a carnivore, and the digestive tract, despite thousands of years of domestication, is intended to assimilate raw meat best. By the same standard, so should humans, and there are a number of people who, of course, believe that humans should only eat raw foods. Humans, of course, are omnivores, so unlike kitty, we can enjoy a carrot every now and then. Of course, the fallacy here is nature is best, and what humans do is imperfect and harmful. So any kind of prepared food that is not raw must somehow be imperfect. Now, of course, this is a falsehood. One of the suspected reasons for the ascent of humans from animals to persons is the advent of cooked food. I would also believe that, you know, most reputable prepared animal foods are nutritious and healthy. There's also a subtle thing that I hadn't thought about before, but comes to mind now, is thousands of years is more than enough time for at least some changes to happen via evolution. And so, I mean, it could be true that although kitty was evolved in the wilds of Africa to only eat raw food, he's been around humans long enough that it's possible that that may have changed. Where I think the raw food people get confused is thanks to the anthropomorphic effect. That is, we no longer see Fido as a dog, but as a person. So when we come home from McDonald's with some chicken nuggets or Wendy's with poutine, we think a person would like that. Fido is to me a person, so Fido must like it. And to varying degrees, Fido may actually enjoy the taste of it. But this definitely falls out of the sort of nutritional food category and points to another factor that pets are different. We can digest milk easily, not a common trait in the pet kingdom. Humans like toxic things like chocolate and alcohol. Remember, our pets are often magnitude sizes smaller than we are, and these toxins can quickly become fatal to our pets. I think that the raw food argument is fallacious overall based on the naturalistic fallacy. That said, its roots, however, do have a certain soundness in that we should not feed our pets what we feed ourselves. Ethan, you own a slave. I mean, you own a pet. What do you feed it? Do any of the people treats slip into its bowl?
Yeah. Well, no, I don't feed my dog human food. I mean, the part of the problem with the so-called raw food movement is that it's well, for one thing, it's not even good for humans. But second of all, I mean, animals, we get the mistaken impression that dogs and cats have been evolutionarily created by nature, when in reality, they're much more human-driven evolution. We've selectively bred these animals to be a certain way. And whether we did it intentionally with dogs, for example, or perhaps unintentionally with cats being, you know, good mousers, but the idea that animals can get back to nature by eating raw flesh is totally wrong. We have bred our animals to do a very specific purpose, that is to live in our homes and amuse us. And in order for them to do that healthy, they need constant medical supervision. They need to get their rabies shots. They need to eat proper food that's been prepared for animals of their nature. If you're going to bring in a raccoon, yeah, maybe you should feed it raw meat. If you're going to, you know, have a tiger, which you shouldn't, but if you did, feed it raw meat. But if you're going to go down to the pound and pick up a dachshund, yeah, you got to feed a kibble. I mean, like there are certain requirements that these animals have that other animals don't have.
They're not getting, quote unquote, sort of a balanced meal because they're not in sort of their natural habitat, even if you assume that. I mean, I get a kick out of some of the flavors you get, you know, beef, pork or whatever. But when's the last time you ever seen a cat take down a cow? I mean, really.
Dogs will eat anything, right? Like, I mean, dogs are food-motivated animals. Most, they're scavengers. Any scavenger will eat what it can get. I've seen dogs eat like rocks. I mean, they will literally eat anything they can get their mouth around. So the idea that like a dog's going to go, poutine, I will try that. You know, like, no, they'll just eat anything.
Okay, so sadly, that's sort of the best I could say about it all. The recipe begins to head deep into sort of quackland. Although I could only find the one mention of Facebook promoting homeopathy on the orphan site, the Pet Turnship Project has a huge support for this sort of unmedicine. So they have links on their site to the American Council of Animal Naturopathy, College of Animal Homeopathy, Homeopathic Remedies in Pets, and Explanation of Homeopathy. The last one tries to explain how homeopathic medicine works. It states, water has the ability to record the energy of emotions. Homeopathy is a healing method that neutralizes the disease force, deleting the energy of the disease and allowing the patient to heal. Now, of course, those of you who know a bit about homeopathy, there's a whole bunch of this. But on the website that they use to sort of support this, they based it largely on the efforts and quotes of a, quote, Dr. Masaru Emoto, whom they claim is both a doctor and a university professor. His legitimate credentials is a Bachelor of Arts in International Relations. His doctorate, however, is a Doctorate of Alternative Medicine from the Indian Board of Alternative Medicine in India, which is an unaccredited institution. Traditionally, those are seen as sort of diploma mills. His university professorship, as best I can track down, seems to be his president emeritus of the International Water for Life Foundation, a nonprofit, probably a nonprofit, that does no teaching and is a foundation that he created himself. So, again, if you do a little research about this particular doctor, you find out that it's just based on complete quack. So, Ethan, maybe you can help me, because I'm getting a little tongue-tied here, because this is such a big issue. What exactly is wrong with homeopathy?
Well, the first thing that I noticed, they couldn't even get homeopathy right on that description. If you're going to be practice a pseudoscience, at least do your research and practice it right. But anyway, so I've encountered this before, homeopathy for pets. In fact, it's a big problem in the pet community. Part of the reason is because people treat their pets sort of like little children. And for some people, they are little children. The problem is, though, is that there's a lot of disposable income amongst these people. And they're willing to spend it to, you know, see their little furry babies happy. And one of the things that I found out of my research is that some of the more popular and trendy dog trainers and organizations that provide resources for dog owners also advocate for homeopathy. So unlike, well, like a human being, if a dog is sick, it needs medical treatment. And one of the best ways to ensure that your dog doesn't get sick is vaccinations, like vaccinations against rabies and a whole other bunch of illnesses that animals can get. When they get something like an infection or an illness, like human beings, they respond well to science-based medicine. Now, homeopathy, of course, is not science-based medicine. It's relying on magic to cure illness, which is not going to work in humans, and it's not going to work in pets either. I mean, I've heard arguments on both sides of whether or not animals have the placebo effect. My initial reaction from reading some cursory research indicates that that's probably not true. Animals don't have a placebo effect. I don't understand how they could, but I could be wrong. Maybe they do have a placebo effect, but either way, the placebo effect is going to make you feel better when you have vague muscle pain, but it's not going to cure things like cancer or, you know, heal an infection you get from chewing on wood, which is something that dogs will do. So homeopathy for pets, it's almost worse if that's possible, because a pet can't say no. Remember how we were saying dogs will eat anything? Well, they'll also take anything because they don't understand what it means to take medicine. So if you give them a pill and they swallow it, they don't realize they've just swallowed homeopathy, and you've done that animal a disservice.
Okay, so we've kind of had the best and the worst, and there's sort of a lot in between, such as promotion of acupuncture, herbalism, chiropractic, and others. It's funny, on one of the raw food retail sites, they were also selling multivitamins in the form of kelp extract. Although I thought, of course, they were saying that an animal gets everything it needs from raw food, and they were even pushing things like bee pollen for, quote, poor immune systems. Well, it seems pet medicine is as infected with quackery and woo as human medicines. However, I think there is sort of a great evil being done here. And Ethan, you kind of alluded to this. If we were to go to an alternative clinic, I would be doing so with at least the possibility of being an informed patient. That's not an option for our pets. They are literally at our mercy. They're at the mercy of their owner. And it gets worse. I mean, I can talk, and if the medication makes me feel worse or causes suffering or pain, I can let a real doctor know. I can let my friends know. A pet can communicate on some levels, but we're anthropomorphizing our pets, and that will betray us here again. As Ethan kind of mentioned, Altman relies upon the placebo effect, anecdotal evidence, and confirmation bias. When we sort of examine Fido after a treatment, we will see what we want to see. So our pet may be no better off or even in a worse condition than before, but our psychology will interpret their behavior like we would want it to do. I mean, the placebo effect, irrespective of whether it would affect Fido or not, it's going to affect me as the owner. So I know that, you know, if I got medicine and I would feel better, so Fido must also be feeling better. If he seems worse, I know sometimes medicine will taste a little bad and might put him in a bad mood, but again, I know what Fido must be feeling. All the time, the animal under your care is suffering and has no way of effectively expressing it. At least I could benefit from the placebo effect, as I say, because at least I understand it's supposed to help. I don't agree with people who say that your animal will get it. It may enjoy some more attention, but it doesn't understand. Therefore, the placebo effect can't really work. Some treatments like chiropractor have proven to have no benefits at all in animals. And actually, they also harmful side effects like migraines, joint pain, nerve damage. Again, all these things that an animal just can't sort of treatment. And of course, there are the countless deaths that are a result of untreatment of our pets by going to these alternative practitioners. Although most of the links from the orphanage and peternship promote combined care, that is, they know, and I am projecting here, that alternative medicine does nothing but impoverish the owner. So they recommend that you go to a regular veterinarian and get, quote, Western medical treatment, but use their quack treatments to supplement and, quote, boost the immune system or support the liver or what have you. If it works well for them, because if they only used alt medicine, then the number of pet deaths would ultimately end up being sort of a diminishment of their client base and thus their profits. However, if they promote the sort of combining real medicine, they can claim that it was all AltMed that really did the job, right? You know, when I started researching this topic, I was thinking I would cover a new range of whacked out medical treatment for pets. But honestly, I was disappointed. They all really just seemed to be sort of regular quack treatments used by people regurgitated for our pets. In an odd way, sort of proving the uselessness of them. I mean, they are relying on spillover from AltMed for people to sell their AltMed for pets, because really the person and the human order is really the same target. And animals and people are not the same sort of thing. So why would the same kind of medicines work for them? If you ever take a look at the medical treatment they give in a real veterinarian, it's very different treatments, very different chemicals, very different medicines they use than humans. And in fact, it can be quite deadly to swap them out. That's why I think it's a bit more of actually an ethical story here. When you accept the responsibility to care for another, be it a child or a pet, you must make an extra effort to ensure the decisions do no harm or endanger the dependent. And sadly, it may be up to you to do the research. A recent survey showed that most veterinarians do not use evidence-based approach to care. That is, researching scientific studies, reading accredited journals, and weighing the merits of the research. Now, apparently most vets base their treatment on anecdotal evidence, Google searches, and essentially trial and error. So like when you get a doctor, you should have a sit down and ask, what is their healthcare philosophy? If they start telling you about energy fields or the like, if they worry that too many vaccinations can cause cancer, if they can't show you a credit journal, you should really find a better vet. Your pet deserves it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, you take on a responsibility when you get that pet. And in some cases, you can be held responsible in a court of law if you neglect your responsibilities as a pet owner.
That's true. Although it's one of those things is that you claim you're doing treatment. It's different because, I mean, with AltMed, I mean, you can't really claim that it's negligence. And that's really what most of the animal protection laws go against. They either go against negligence or outright violence to your animal. And this doesn't seem to fit into either category greatly. This seems like a different level that actually, you know, it should rest upon the owners of the pets, but also it relies on the vets and all that who are the practitioners of medicine. But you don't have that because, well, after all, animals are only animals. And if Fido dies, you can just get another one. What is really the value of animal life? And in one sense, I mean, I'm not trying to say that, you know, a dog is equal to a human, but when you get a pet, you are kind of making that equation.
Well, the other aspect of it is that if you don't get your dog a rabies shot and he goes out and bites a human being, not only have you basically signed the dog's death warrant, but you've endangered the community. And in most communities, ownership of violent dog breeds is the same as owning a weapon. So you can be criminally liable for your dog's actions. So, I mean, by all means, make sure that your dog has the proper vaccinations, because if you were the source of an outbreak, better bet that you will be held responsible for that.
So I guess one last thought on this, and actually it's not going to be my thought. I'm going to throw this over to Ethan, because Ethan, you have a pet. And how does it make you feel when someone stands up and they take the responsibility of caring for this animal, and then they sort of throw it away by going to a practitioner of homeopathic medicine? How does that make you feel?
If you do not have either the financial or the critical thinking